Hello, everybody. Welcome back once again to another episode of Mind Shift. As always, I am your host, Dr. Clint Haycock, and I am very interested in helping you to think critically about such topics as God, the state of the church today, and spirituality. And in today's episode, we're going to be getting into part two of the chat I had recently with David Fitzgerald, who is an atheist. He's a mythicist as well as an author. Probably the most popular book that he's written is called Nailed: 10 Christian Myths That Show Jesus Never Existed at All. And his most recent publication is called Jesus Mything in Action. If you listened to last week's episode, you'll recall that we got into this question of the historicity of Jesus. Did the person called Jesus of Nazareth that we read about in the Gospels really exist? Or was he simply, as David argued last week, a mythical figure that was created by a variety of biblical authors and then later editors from a literary and theological construct? And of course, if David is correct about his assertion, then this has massive and profound implications, certainly for Christianity and the reading of the Gospels, the question of the reliability, the trustworthiness, the veracity of the Gospels when it comes to their account of this figure called Jesus. In last week's episode, we got into the question of the historical veracity of Jesus in terms of the Gospel record as well as outside the Gospel. Is there historical evidence, extra-biblical evidence, to prove that Jesus actually existed and that he did all the things that the Gospels claim that he did, or at least some of them? And David's argument, of course, is that there isn't any. Well, in this week's episode, we're going to get into the implications of what all this begins to mean if David's assertion, as I say, is in fact true and Jesus never existed at all. What does that mean in simply general terms for Christianity? But we're also going to look at this issue of Christians and politics today. Certainly in America, we see the church feels very embattled and very much under pressure, under siege. And this attack, as they would see it by a person like David, against the very core personality of Christianity, Christ himself, they would see that as a direct attack on the very fundamentals of the faith. And so you can see how persecuted they feel. And this is what we get into in just a few minutes. So stay tuned for that. Now, I just want to say really quickly before we get into the conversation with David that there's a couple of ways you can get a hold of me on social media. I'm on Twitter at MindShift2018, and I'll put my other social media connections and contacts in the show notes. I also want to say a couple of other things about supporting this show. You can become a supporter of MindShift for as little as $1 a month. If you want to go to patreon.com/mindshiftpodcast, there's some more information about what it means to be a supporter of the show and what some of the rewards are. You can also buy a Mindshift Podcast t-shirt on TeePublic, and I'll put, again, those links in the show notes. Now, before I bring you the second half with David in just a few minutes, I thought it'd be interesting to take a quick look at a historical figure. One of the things that I love to do is look at the historical context. How do these doctrines and teachings come out of the past in terms of Christianity, in terms of the church? Because as theologian Stanley Gren said, all doctrines are historically and culturally conditioned. One of the things we talked about last week was this so-called quest for the historical Jesus. And if you remember from last week's episode, we talked about Albert Schweitzer. Now, he wasn't the first one to be on this quest for the historical Jesus around the 18th and 19th century. But he was the one who popularized that phrase, the quest of the historical Jesus, with his book that came out in 1906. And I think it's very interesting to look at historical figures that come out of this time period because you have to understand the historical context. It's in the midst of the Industrial Revolution. There's incredible progress in science and technology and industry. And yet at the same time, in Victorian Britain, as well as in the late 19th century and early 20th century in America as well, there was also grinding poverty, incredible urban decay in these major cities like New York and London. And this is one of the greatest ironies of this age. You had incredible wealth fueled by industry and empire juxtaposed against terrible poverty, crime, drunkenness, child labor, prostitution was incredibly widespread. Millions of people were crammed into these big inner cities and lived in terrible slums, and these conditions did not go unnoticed by politicians and preachers alike. So what was the church doing about all this? Well, they were too busy arguing over the assaults on the Bible, as they saw it, by German liberal scholarship. And this movement coincided with this same time frame, coming out of the late 18th and early 19th centuries. And this was a huge deal. It posed a massive threat to Christianity on one level. At least the fundamentalists saw it that way. They saw it as an attack on the Bible. But the more liberal theologians, of course, as we've talked about in other podcasts, they tried to synthesize their Christian faith with the modern sciences and the modern historical criticism of the Bible. And one of the guys that was a leading figure around the end of the 19th and early 20th century was the American pastor and theologian Walter Rauschenbusch. And what's interesting about Walter Rauschenbusch is that beginning in 1886, he became the pastor of a tiny little church called Second German Baptist Church, right on the edge of Hell's Kitchen in New York City, one of the most crime-infested, terrible slums in the world at the time. And what Rauschenbusch discovered that as he tried to work with the people that lived in Hell's Kitchen, that his lovely conservative education in theological schools had not in any way prepared him to deal with the crime and the poverty and the horrible conditions in this city. And he found it harder and harder to reconcile this personal Jesus, this personal gospel that he'd been taught that he needed to preach. And he began to read more liberal scholars, and he began to form this idea that the church must be involved in social reform. And part of this message came out of this idea that there was a historical person called Jesus who actually lived. And this is something David and I touched on last week. But what the liberal scholars believed is that the real person of Jesus had been obscured by layers and layers and layers of traditions in the Gospels themselves, and that we needed to go back and understand the true historical context, the true historical Jesus, the real person that lived and not the person that we read about in the Gospels. And Rauschenbusch ended up writing a book in 1907 called Christianity and the Social Crisis. And there's some really interesting quotes in there. And you see that he's onto this idea that Christianity has always used or abused Jesus and nothing really changes. He says, quote, "Christians had always bowed in worship before their master," meaning Jesus, "but they had never undertaken to understand his life in its own historical environment and his teachings in the sense in which Jesus meant them to be understood by his hearers. He'd always stood, like one of his pictures in Byzantine art, splendid against its background of gold, but unreal and unhuman. Slowly," he says, "and still with many uncertainties and details, his figure is coming out of the past to meet us. He has begun to talk to us as he did to his Galilean friends, and the better we know Jesus," he says, "the more social do his thoughts and aims become," unquote. And what's interesting about this whole thing is that he concludes that people are using and abusing the Jesus of the gospel. He concludes by saying, quote, "Under the influence of this new historical study of Christ, and under the pressure of the intense new social interest in contemporary life, the pendulum is now swinging the other way. Men are seizing on Jesus as the exponent of their own social convictions. They all claim him. He was the first socialist. Nay, he was a Tolstoyan anarchist. Not at all. He was an upholder of law and order, a fundamental opponent of the closed shop." And he concludes by saying, "It is a great tribute to his power over men and to the many-sidedness of his thought that they all seek shelter in his great shadow," end quote. And I referenced last week Hector Avalos' statement that I've talked about a lot before, that all God talk is self-referential. And basically, this is what Rauschenbusch was saying over 100 years ago, that people have used and abused Jesus to make him whatever figure they want him to be. And this is still going on even today. But of course, Rauschenbusch and the other liberal scholars, they believe they could go back and find the quote-unquote historical Jesus, the real person that actually lived, dig through the layers of accretions in the Gospels and find the real person. And what Rauschenbusch discovered, or he felt he discovered, was this Jesus who was a social activist who stood up against the oppressive regime, the establishment, and fought back. And that's the kind of social gospel that Rauschenbusch and others tried to construct around the turn of the century. But of course, people like Rauschenbusch never really entertained the notion, they wouldn't even thought about the question of whether or not Jesus actually existed at all. And so let's go on into this conversation with David Fitzgerald and see if we can't unpack some of the implications, whether or not Jesus was actually a true historical figure or not. What does it mean in terms of Christianity, politics, and the state of the church going forward today? So let's go on into, did Jesus exist or was he just a myth, with David Fitzgerald, part two.
But what's really crazy is, especially when you hear Christians bragging about how our scriptures are 99.99999% identical to the original writings, and we are very confident about that. How do they know they are pulling that right out of their butt? Because for the first 150 to 200 years of Christianity, we have no existing text at all, whatsoever. Even if we could magically find a text that was original and had been preserved miraculously all these thousands of years, if we found it today, we wouldn't know it was the original. We'd say, oh, here's a weird variant form of Mark that was probably written by some heretics later. We'd have no way of knowing that that's the original. What we do know is that no existing biblical text matches any other biblical text 100%.
So what does that demonstrate? That actually Christianity was far more diverse than we may have been led to believe?
Far more diverse, and we may never be able to track down just how different it was in the very beginning. Just like we have found many, many parts of the New Testament that are interpolations and forgeries and changes, and even there's even warnings in the letters of Paul about people forging letters in his name, ironically, in one of the letters that's agreed to be a forgery.
The ultimate irony.
Yeah, it is ultimate irony. We don't have any way of sussing out all of them, and we're sure we haven't found every single one of them. But it's this question of what was written originally. How much of it was saved? Why did they only save the books of Paul? Why were so many books forged in his name and not anybody else's? There's a century of early Christian literature that we should have. We should have it from the disciples. We should have it from the Jerusalem church leaders. We should at least have church records of some sort or church history. Instead, we have forgeries written generations after the fact from people who almost admit outright that that's what they're doing. Luke claims to be, he's the only one who even claims to be writing history. But all our four Gospels, the reason they're called the Gospel according to Mark, according to Matthew, according to Luke, and not the Gospel by Mark, by Matthew, by Luke, is because they weren't by those names. They were originally all written anonymously, and those names were attached sometime in the second century when different church groups were feuding over who had the best Gospels and who had the best epistles and Acts. And they did that by saying, well, this came from Matthew. Well, this came from Mark. Well, this came from his favorite, the beloved disciple. It came from Mary herself. And that arms race of trying to find a way that ties it straight back to Jesus all came out generations later in the second century.
I cannot imagine churches feuding, David. You got to be kidding me.
Well, you know what's ironic is before we even had a New Testament, it never occurred to any Christians that we should have a collection of writings until a heretical group, Marcion, decided he was going to create a collection of Paul's letters and of Gospels. That when he sent up that theological Sputnik, our church fathers said, oh no, we better put up one too. And there you have the New Testament.
There you have it. You kind of touched base on this doctrine of inerrancy. You didn't mention that word, but it seemed like that's what you were referring to, going back a little bit to what you just said a few minutes ago, because this is something we've talked about on some other podcasts. That's a classic stock evangelical or fundamentalist answer to this whole problem.
Right. It has to be inerrant because it can only be for theological reasons. But when they realize that there's no way they can actually justify that because none of our scriptures match up with each other 100%, yes. And even if you recognize, oh, that's just a spelling mistake, oh, that's just a grammar mistake, that's fine. I'm not even worried about those. What I am worried about is the deliberate changes that are specifically made to change the meaning and make it the opposite of what one says or one not doesn't, and that we have no way of knowing which is the correct original reading. And even sincere, devoted, Bible-believing biblical scholars come to opposite conclusions about which is the original reading. So for them to be so smug and so discontentious and dismissive about the thought that they have the original Gospels, that's ridiculous. It's completely ridiculous.
You said the key that I'd seized on is, you said the doctrine of inerrancy, it was for theological reasons. That's why the doctrine was crafted. Absolutely. At the end of the 19th century by the fundamentalists, because they were so worried about the attacks on the Bible from historical criticism that they said, in effect, we have to protect the Bible from these attacks from without. So we're going to put together this doctrine of inerrancy. And the ironic thing about it is, of course, as you said, it only applies to the original autographs, what they say are the original documents, right, which, of course, they turn around and say, we admit we don't have, but
exactly,
the Bible's been preserved.
Exactly.
Their argument is, through the miraculous preservation of the Holy Spirit and God, the text has been preserved through textual criticism. So what we have today,
yeah,
I read an article the other day that said, what we have today is 98% accurate to those originals, which we don't have.
Yeah.
Now that
numbers they are pulling right out of their flying monkey butts, because there,
yeah,
is no way they would even know how accurate their texts are. And we know they're not accurate. We know there are forgeries. We know there are interpolations still in our Bibles now. And some of them still get happily printed as if they're not forgery, even though we know they're forgery. There's different endings to the Gospels that we don't have in ours. You just, if you're lucky, your Bible translation will have a footnote saying some other ancient authorities say something else in here, or something, euphemism for this is not necessarily the original.
Yeah, that's a very good point. I was just thinking, for example, John chapter 8, there's a good example of a variant reading. Most of the Gospels will have a note in there on John chapter 8 that'll say something like, most ancient authorities do not include this story, this little narrative of Jesus rescuing the woman who was caught in adultery. And that's not
absolutely
in some of the other versions, some of the other texts that we have.
That's a perfect example, too, because the story of the woman caught in adultery is one of the most beloved Christian stories out there, and yet that is one of the ones that we can point to for sure and say, okay, we know that wasn't part of the original ones because, A, it's not in our oldest manuscripts. And when it does start showing up hundreds of years later, it shows up in different places and in different with different endings and different versions of it.
It's a characterization of that Jesus, isn't it?
That's one example.
And the other one is, of course, 1 John 5:7, which is a classic Trinitarian text, but that's not in the older manuscripts that we do have. It's a great text if you're
right,
arguing, if you're trying to argue with a Jehovah's Witness about the Trinity, but of course, it's not in the older manuscripts.
But it's nonsense, yeah. The whole Trinitarian doctrine, of course, doesn't even come until hundreds of years after those books are written anyway. And we have church historians like Eusebius saying that, oh, he has manuscripts where it doesn't say the Father, Son, the Holy Spirit. It says three other different witnesses, like the blood and the salt and the spirit, or something more eclectic than that.
It's funny.
That makes no sense in a Trinitarian context.
Even if we had an original manuscript, we wouldn't know that it was an original. It reminds me, several years ago, I was over in Dublin in Ireland. If you've ever been over there, there's this place called the Chester Beatty Library. Did you go to the Chester Beatty Library?
I wish I had. I went to the Shamrafada in Trinity College to see the Book of Kells.
Book of Kells,
But yeah, I wish I had a chance to drop in on the Chester Beatty Papyri because those are some of our best New Testament.
Some of the oldest manuscripts or fragments, I should say. And I was thinking about that because they think it's one of the oldest manuscripts or fragment from the Book of John. And they say that could be one of the originals. We don't know. This could be something that John himself wrote. But I'm thinking it's, again, what you said, it's complete speculation. We know it's an ancient piece of parchment. That's for sure.
Right.
But even if it was
honestly
original, you'd never know it.
I was going to say, if we're talking about specifically the John Rylands papyrus, P52,
yes,
that was so long touted as the oldest fragment of John, it turned out in between the time I wrote the book Nailed and the book Jesus Mything in Action, it turned out it was just the Christian biblical scholars who were saying, oh yeah, this comes from as early as 125 in the second century, which is still pretty damn late if you're trying to say somebody who hung out with Jesus was still writing, 90 years after his death. But it turns out that the papyrologists, the paprologists, if you will, the experts on that, never claimed it was as early as 125. They said, no, it's a 75-year range from as early as 125 to as late as 300, and it's probably as late as 200 rather, not 300. But it's probably a second or third, a late second or early third century fragment.
Yeah, so it couldn't be an original.
It's not even anywhere as old, which ironically enough, too, means that our oldest gospel fragment is from a fragment, the Egerton Papyrus, that's not one of our four gospels. So our oldest Christian gospel fragment is from a gospel that's not in our Bibles.
Right, it never made it in.
Again, the irony is just off the hook.
That's a big one. I want to keep hitting my mind that even if we had an original, we wouldn't know it. Because it's not like they wrote in the margins, hey guys, this is John writing. This is an original text. This is the first one. Or this is Paul here. I'm signing this and you know this is an original. And like you said, the variant readings would be probably so diverse that we would probably dismiss it as a false reading or a variant reading. It's quite interesting.
Absolutely. I want to make one quick correction, Clint. Yeah. We actually do have letters of Paul that do say, oh, I am Paul and I am writing this. And they're forgeries.
It's too obvious. In other words, the author is going so far out of his way to prove, quote unquote, that he is Paul, that his assertion then that he is definitely the Paul who wrote this letter, it's almost too conspicuous then in a funny way.
And it's kind of a catch-22 because if that's a legitimate letter and not a forgery, well, that means people as early as Paul's generation were forging letters in his name already. Or... Yeah. If it's not true, well, there's your evidence right there that it's a forgery. You can't escape the fact that as early as Paul, people were forging letters. Christians were forging letters in his name.
Yeah, I was going to say the fact that he even mentions that it's a problem at the time, or if it's what he's writing.
Yep.
Now, I'm curious to find out, what are the implications for Christianity if what you're saying is true? And you've done your historical research, you've done your documentary evidence, and you come up and said, I can't find anything contemporary outside of the Gospels. What are the implications for Christianity? And what's some of the pushback that you've gotten from, let's say, conservatives, evangelicals, about your book and some of the writings and talks that you've done? Are you getting a warm reception?
Well, it's very funny, actually, because the reception has changed over time. The Christians have never liked it, but they've always dismissed it and poo-pooed it as if, oh no, this is old stuff, this has been taken care of long ago. But the longer that my book Nailed came out, the more, and I mean, it's not just me, of course, I mean, this whole movement over the last 15 years or so is making waves because I see, for instance, like Christian billboards saying, Jesus, he's not made up, he is real, you know, and it's starting to get under their skin when they're realizing they don't have any really good arguments against it. And the best they could do is say, well, we don't know, and you can't prove that he didn't exist. But when the best you can do is say, well, we have to be agnostic about it, you've got a problem. The biggest surprise when I wrote Nailed in 2010 was not that the Christians all hated it, but how many atheists hated it and said, oh, no, this is pseudo-history, this is pseudo-science. We know there was a guy named Jesus. We have good evidence for Jesus. All biblical scholars agree there was a Jesus, but he just wasn't the Son of God. And no, that's not the point at all, full stop. So when I wrote Nailed was mostly trying to debunk the ways that Christianity's top 10 ways that Christianity's official story fails. And so a lot of atheists said, okay, yeah, you're just debunking the Christians, Jesus, but there really wasn't a Jesus. So after years of saying, no, there wasn't, I wrote the book Jesus, Mything, and Action that actually talks about, okay, let's take this question. Let's say there was a Jesus. What's our evidence for him? What's our sources say? And how reliable are those sources? When you turn it around and say, okay, let's look for Jesus, that's where he starts falling apart super fast. And that's what I do in Jesus, Mything, and Action, as I point out that, yeah, there wasn't even a guy named Jesus. There wasn't even several guys who got lumped together to become a guy named Jesus. This came right out of the box, allegorical, celestial, a fictional, mythological Jesus. Well, you know, another question, too, is, point I wanted to make is, when that book came out in 2010, I got a lot of crap from atheists. When Jesus, Mything, and Action came out 7 years later, so much less crap. The reaction has been so much more positive. And it's because, I think, all these atheists who were saying, oh, come on, let's not fall into this pseudo-history bullshit, you know, let's get the story straight, were realizing, oh, yeah, the evidence isn't very good for him, is it? And that's why I tell people, I'm not out to make make you a Jesus atheist like me, but at the very least, when you look at the evidence that we have and how bad it is, you should be a militant Jesus atheist, agnostic, so that when people say, do you believe there was a Jesus? You say, I don't know, and you don't either.
Maybe that's where we have to come down on this whole thing. That's the whole point, isn't it? Because you have to say to yourself, is there actual documentary evidence outside of the Gospels, extra-biblical written evidence or archaeological evidence, which we don't have, that actually proves that Jesus actually existed?
Well, yeah, exactly. And here's the thing. I mean, I'm very comfortable saying, you know what? I don't think there was any chance in hell that there was an actual person named Jesus, just like I don't think there could have been a Moses, an Abraham, or fill in the blank for most of the Old Testament, many of the Old Testament figures that we love. But that said, I don't think we should start our arguments with Christians with it. It's such a non-starter for them. But I do think it's very important for atheists to be arguing about it, because no matter who comes out on top at the end of the day, whether it's me and the mythicist, or it's Bart Ehrman and the historicist, everything we learn in this back and forth, going over the historical evidence for Jesus, helps us call the bluff of anybody who's trying to tell you that they know how Jesus wants you to behave or think or vote. And that is super important for atheists.
That's when you start getting into politics and morality, and you co-opt
Absolutely.
This Jesus. Well, surely there's got to be another aspect to this whole conversation as well. In other words, what lies behind this whole thing, it really raises the question of God himself, doesn't it? For example, you could take a look at this doctrine of inerrancy, what a lot of conservative Christians believe, this doctrine that they really cling to in order to preserve the Bible against whatever attacks may come against it. The argument is as follows. They say, okay, this is how that we know the Bible is inerrant. God only speaks the truth. He cannot lie.
Right.
Therefore, everything right. that is in the Bible is true because it's the Word of God and it's inspired
right.
and therefore error-free because God himself cannot lie and he only speaks the truth. So it says everything about
Absolutely.
God's own nature. So if you start questioning the reliability of the Gospels and the rest of the Scripture,
yeah.
what are you saying about God's trustworthiness and truth-telling? What that's got to cast huge
Absolutely.
Aspersions on the character of God if you work the argument backwards.
And that's what makes this so pernicious. It's like Christians can't even give an inch on this for argument's sake.
They can't
this
afford
is kryptonite
to.
For Christianity. It's so toxic. If nothing else, it points out that all their faith is based on nothing but faith, wishful thinking. They don't have the evidence to back up what they're claiming.
It's circular
and
logic.
And that's true. That's true whether there was a Jesus or not. Whether there was a Jesus or not, the evidence for Jesus is still shitty. Whether there was a real Jesus at the bottom of it, or if it's myths all the way down, either way, the Gospels are myths about somebody, whether they're purely mythical or myths about something got slapped on somebody. They are myths. The Christian's God is a myth, debunked either way.
And you can see that we talked about this the other day about the response of evangelicals in North or America today, this whole thing about voting for Donald Trump, and there's been volumes and volumes written on how evangelicals are overlooking all the moral problems and everything else because Trump, above everything else, promised to protect their religion, which they believe is under attack
yeah,
from
absolutely.
People like you, unfortunately, and Hector Avalos
absolutely.
And David Madison and Christopher Hitchens and Dawkins and everybody else. And so it would,
yep.
it does make sense from that point of view. They feel embattled, so they're going to vote for the candidate who promises, and he's appointing conservative judges and all the rest of it, and they're breathing huge sighs of relief. He's following through on their promises, his promises.
They
That's what he said.
They don't even care that he's a traitor and working for Putin, basically.
He's a puppet.
I said this on Facebook when it happened. It says, how ironic that the only people who believe there's an Antichrist are the ones who went out and voted for him in droves.
They called Obama the Antichrist, though, before that, didn't they?
Well, they've called everybody an Antichrist since Napoleon and since
Hitler,
Genghis Khan and
Stalin. Yeah.
Antichrist has been with us from the very beginning.
Many Antichrists.
He's always around the corner. Just like Obama's always ready to take our guns, the Antichrist is always waiting in the wing to kick off Armageddon.
It's a huge question, and I can see I can hear the fear and the that's the sense of being embattled and being persecuted?
Yep.
Because that's the question someone asked me the other day. What's the future of Christianity? You know, is it going to die out in the next 100, 200 years? And I said, I don't think so, because humanity, we're incurably religious. We have this sense of spirituality and wonder and religion. Many people have said that Christianity was going to be gone at a certain point, and it hasn't been. It's been around for
right.
a couple thousand years, and I don't think it's going to fade away because, unfortunately, because you wrote a book that maybe debunks a lot.
Well, that's true. It's not because anybody wrote a book, but you know what might happen? Christianity has been an example of Darwinian evolution in action right from the beginning, and so it will certainly mutate and keep evolving and keep adapting to all these new threats and harsh environments. But one thing I have noticed that's very interesting, ever since 9/11, ever since the rise of the internet, the younger generations of college-age kids in particular are getting less and less religious. The last figures that I was checking showed about a third split, almost perfectly down the line, of openly religious, openly secular, and spiritual but not religious, whatever that means. So the numbers are going down, and Christianity is shrinking. Unfortunately, it's shrinking by losing the most rational and the most compassionate people first, and it's the most fact-proof, nut-job, wing-nuts, gun-loving Christians that are left. So it's getting smaller, but it's also getting louder and uglier and more desperate. It's an interesting time to be alive.
The Westboro Baptist type of people, they're a very small minority, but they're incredibly loud, incredibly vocal, and I don't think they're getting as much attention maybe now as they were 5 or 6 years ago, but that's the kind of demographic that we're talking about, isn't it? The righteous remnant that's clinging to their guns and their American flags, and they've got God and Jesus in there too somehow, and that's what you're left with?
Yep.
Is that what Christianity is going to become? Wow, that's unbelievable.
We'll find out, but honestly, the evidence is out there, and the Christians know it. They know it, too, that they're losing the young people.
That's another trend as well that you were talking about. The millennials are leaving the church in droves, and they're fed
Absolutely.
Up with it. They're fed up with the embracing of right-wing candidates and overlooking all these problems that they were the ones chanting the loudest when Bill Clinton was having, you know, affairs with Monica Lewinsky about family values. And
it's so ironic to see what the Republicans were complaining about under Clinton and under Obama, and what they totally let Trump get away with without blinking an eye. The hypocrisy is just off the hook.
Well, he gets a mulligan, as they say.
He gets a mulligan.
He gets a mulligan, whatever that means.
Well, you know,
you get a do-over.
As cynical as I am, I'm optimistic, because Trump's whole stolen election is a blip on the radar as when you see what's happening as far as the progress we've been making. And I think if we can survive this crisis, and it looks like we are, it looks like the noose is finally starting to tighten around him and all his cronies, and they're turning on each other already. We are going to be getting better as a society, as a culture, as a planet, because the young people are getting more and more involved. The old people, the old Fox viewers and the conservatives, they're dying or going senile every day. And every day we're getting three more activists out of college rearing to make the world a better place. So I am optimistic in the long run.
You look at a situation like what's happening in the aftermath of this recent mass shooting in Parkland, Florida. The young people
Absolutely.
Of the school are openly saying to Donald Trump and to the people that are in the back pocket, the NRA, you know, they're beholden to the NRA and gun lobbyists and things like that. They're saying enough is enough. Yeah. If you're not going to do anything, we're going to do something. And they're stepping up. They're going to have a big school walkout. They're organizing a nationwide thing. And so, I'm impressed by the stand that they're taking. If you're not going to do something, then we're going to do it. So I think that's great.
I love it.
If it takes something terrible like another mass shooting. Well, now I'm curious to know, as we kind of wrapping it up, what advice would you give? I always ask everybody that's on the podcast, what advice would you give to someone who's maybe listening to this show, hasn't read your book or come across any of your stuff? This is rocking their world. They're a Christian and they've never heard of this stuff, or they've never really seriously thought about it. What advice would you give to someone? Where can they go to get more information on this subject of the historicity of Jesus as well as, you know, the reliability of the Gospels and some of these other things we've been talking about.
There are so many good books out there, books by Richard Carrier, books by Raphael Lepastor, books by David Madison. On the historicist side, Bart Ehrman, even though he's such a devout historicist, he's one of the best mythicist writers out there, as far as I'm concerned, because his work on forgery in Christianity, just the shenanigans that go on in biblical history circles. Hector Avalos' book, The End of Biblical Studies. All of these books are so good, and there's plenty more that I'm forgetting. Robert Price, everything he's written has been brilliant. Evidence is out there, and you can always find me on Facebook or shoot me an email at everybodylovesdave@gmail.com, and I'm happy to talk to people over it, too.
Are you on Twitter at all? Do you have a Twitter handle?
You know, in theory I do, but I don't do a lot with it. I try to do everything through Facebook that I can, because for the most of the time, I'm just too busy writing to spend a lot of time on social media. So I'm sort of hit or miss. So Facebook and email is the best way to get a hold of me.
Facebook and email is the best way. And I know you have several videos on YouTube. I've posted up a few on the MindShift podcast group, anticipation of this podcast coming out. So hopefully people have had a chance to kind of take a look at some of the stuff that you were talking about and some of the talks that you've done, which is kind of interesting that you've talked to Christian groups as well. When we were talking the other day, you said you were about to talk to a group, an apologetics group at a church in Berkeley. I was going to ask you, how did that go?
That went brilliant. I've been doing that. We figured out we've been doing it for 14 years now.
Wow.
This apologetic group has been bringing kids up to talk to atheists. It's I love it. I think any time you can get Christians and atheists in the same room talking to each other, it's always a good thing.
So nobody brought rotten tomatoes. Nobody threw rocks at you. You can have a good respectful dialogue.
It was fun. It was a good dialogue.
Whole thing, isn't it? It's critical thinking. You've got to be exposed to different points of view and really interact with them. And it is very emotionally threatening. I mean, I understand. Coming out of evangelicalism, coming out of fundamentalism, not only was I a student, I was an academician, I was a teacher, I did all those things, and I'm looking at this and going, yeah, this was a huge part of my adult life. I've spent most of my adult life in ministry or in academics surrounded around this issue of the Bible and teaching the scriptures and everything, so I'm kind of going, where do I go from here? But I'm really glad to meet up with people like you, David Madison, Hector Avalos, just to be able to have this kind of open expansion. So I think it's been great. I'm really happy that you were able to free up your schedule before you went away on a trip, didn't you? You're going away in a couple of days, aren't you?
I'm going to be speaking in Wichita in a few days, yep.
All right. Well, listen, David Fitzgerald, thank you so much for being on the MindShift podcast.
Thanks again for having me, Clint. I've loved speaking to you. If you liked what I had to say about Jesus mysticism, you'll probably like what I have to say about Mormonism in my book on the Mormons. And you might even like our science fiction book, which is called Time Shards, and it's brand new. And I love it. I'm really excited about it. And the reviews have been really dynamite, and I'd love to see people embrace that book as well.
Is that book out?
In that series.
Is it out yet? Is it on Amazon?
That book is
or?
Out now. Book one is out now wherever books are sold in the UK or the U.S., or anywhere in between.
Okay, so look for David Fitzgerald's work, and then what I'll do is I'll put a link to some of your work in the show notes as well, so if people want to get a hold of you or find out more about your research and your writing, they can also look in the show notes as well. So thanks again for being on the show. I will talk to you later. I'm sure we'll stay in touch, and I'm interested to hear where you go from here.
Thanks so much. It's been a pleasure.
Well, I'm going to ask the same question that I did at the end of last week's episode. Did David convince you that Jesus did not exist at all, and that the lack of historical evidence shows that he is probably nothing more than a mythical figure created from a compendium of literary and theological sources? If nothing else, if it's helped you to think critically and perhaps examine some of your own presuppositions around the question of the historicity of Jesus, the validity of the veracity of the gospel record, then I'm happy I've done my job. I've helped you to think critically or at least challenge your worldview and some of your inherited beliefs, especially if you're like me, someone who was not only raised in the church, but also spent many years within the system both as a pastor, a preacher, a leader in churches, as well as a teacher in theological schools, defending these very things that David seeks to debunk or at least question. And I think one of the things that really strikes me in both of these conversations with David is this notion that people can use and abuse Jesus for their own ends. And as David said, you got to be wary of people who are telling you what Jesus wants you to do, how Jesus wants you to vote based on their particular slanted reading of the Gospels. And this is what I've said before in other podcasts, that once you understand that this is what's going on, you'll see it all over the place. People are using Jesus, co-opting him for their own ends, exactly as people like Walter Rauschenbusch warned us over a century ago. So you got to be careful. You've got to look out for people using and abusing Jesus, at least the literary figure that we read about in the Gospels. And this is really totally aside from the question of whether or not he existed at all. So if you found this episode helpful, challenging, thought-provoking, or if it just pissed you off, let me know about it. I'm interested to hear your thoughts, your comments, your feedback. Also, if you want to get in touch with David Fitzgerald, I can do that. You can contact me a variety of ways on social media, and those are in the show notes. I just want to say really quickly before the end of this episode that coming up next week, I'm going to be bringing you Surfing with the Atheist with Tim Malins. He's a friend who I went to school with way back in elementary school and high school back in Seattle in the States. He's going to tell his story about how he was dropped into my little fundamentalist Christian school when he was about 12 or 13 years old. And we're going to hear his amazing story of his journey, how these doctrines in fundamentalist Christianity affected him, and then later how he became an atheist and where he is now. So don't miss that next Friday. And I've also discovered that I've had too many men on this show. We're going to go into a season where we've got some fantastic women coming out on this podcast. After Tim Malins, we're going to have a few episodes from a friend of mine, Dana Stinson, who is telling an absolutely amazing, unbelievable story. She is a trans woman, but she was raised in the church. Her parents were pastors, but all the time she was battling with this whole issue of gender identity. This is a story not to be missed. Also, I've got some women coming up as well who are contributors to Karen Garst's new book, and they're going to be bringing us the African-American female perspective on church, civil rights movement, racism, injustice in American society, and more. So stay tuned for those coming up in the next couple of months. I hope this has been challenging, stimulating, interesting, thought-provoking. And if that has indeed been the case, please give me your thoughts, let me know your feedback and questions. I have been your host, Dr. Clint Haycock, and I thank you once again for joining me and David Fitzgerald over these last couple of weeks right here on Mindshift, and I'll see you next Friday.